You are listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to westhill.net/donate.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Wei Zhao, the reader today. I remember sometime last year, I think, in one of the sessions in which Greta shared with us her perspectives, that when we Google, we always find the things that we find agreeable first, because that's how Google would kind of tailor those responses if you have looked up certain things online. And certainly we don't read things that we don't kind of like. I certainly don't turn to certain channels of TV, and I don't think I ever bought a book of author that I didn't like. Today, I'm just going to say this. As a reader, I'm going to read something which I kind of don't agree with. But this is the beauty of West Hill, that we are challenged to read things that we don't like. And then as I read those passages, I did think about what the author was trying to say. And I think that's the purpose, to make us think. And whether or not we change our opinions is another thing. So that's my little preface and a kind of like a prejudicial introduction to what I'm going to say later. Okay. We wish to acknowledge that we are on the traditional territory of the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nations lands, which lands were previously occupied by the Seneca and Huron-Wendat First Nations.
I'm doing a great deal of reading right now on the dilemma in moral philosophy. It very simply goes this way. How do you know what goodness is? What fact do you base it on? Do you say that goodness is a fact, and then all the philosophers rush in and say, so define it, please, and any way you define it, you're just repeating it. So they wonder if it's a fact or not. Now, there are tomes and tomes and stacks of books on this subject. And then they go over and say, okay, then we have to ground it on something that is a fact. And the big dilemma is, how do you get from a fact, like there's the chair, to a value, it's a good chair? How do you get from a fact to a value? Now, you don't even have to follow that. It's huge, and people argue for years on it. But what we try to do here is to say, there is an element that you have to put in after the fact. Because I could tell you 1,000 facts about what's wrong in the world, and you could stare at me and say, so what? It's wrong. There it is. The inserted value we put there, and it has to be a choice. The fact can sit there as real. We choose that because of those facts, we want to enter those facts with the value of love. And there's a funny little picture. I did my next picture there, Peter. Peter? Yeah. So that's the idea, that we talk about the web of life, and you hear about it all the time on the news. And there's that connection, the web of life, love and suffering and death unites all beings. But if the heart wasn't behind it, you could still say, so what? So we're all connected. That's too bad. Adding that thing of love, that's what we add as a choice to say, okay, it does matter. It does matter. It matters because it affects me, and it matters because I affect you. And so I've asked Babette to sing a song this morning that I wrote a long time ago, and it puts that heart into those facts. And then I'm going to just ask Peter to scroll through some pictures after Babette finished of depictions of the web of life. There's a weaving, there's a jigsaw puzzle, there's a quilt, and all these ideas of the web and love that we try to insert the value of love into.
The selections today are taken from H.L. Mencken. First reading. Will our sons and daughters be better off at the dawn of the third millennia than our grandparents were at the start of the 20th century? Nobody would have posed this question in 1900. The answer was too obviously yes. Now many intelligent observers doubt future progress. The 20th century, with its vicious total wars, the Holocaust, ethnic cleansing, and environmental degradation, has put an end to hopes that society and mankind will achieve perfection, and even raises doubts as to whether life will continue to improve. Offered as wisdom for the journey. Second reading. As a quote from H.L. Mencken indicates, change is not progress, but progress requires change. Thus, neither the Big Bang nor evolution necessarily implies progress, although I will argue that both have resulted in advancement. Mankind has made progress. Improvements in society are indispensable and almost inevitable. And economic growth and progress are vital goals. The alternatives to progress are stagnation, deterioration, and eventual extinction of all life. Offered as wisdom for the journey.
I'm just going to introduce Dennis so that he can introduce the TED Talk. We spoke, Annie and I, a few weeks ago and thought that introducing TED Talks on the fifth Sunday of each month, which happens three or four times a year usually. Four times every year.
That's right.
Thank you for that little bit of information. I won't get that much. Four times every year. However, we've already booked someone for the one in September. I'm disappointed too. I don't know how a month with only 30 days gets to have a fifth Sunday in it, but anyway. So I'm delighted. Dennis and Eleanor watch a TED Talk pretty much every day. So that's why we gave them the job of curating which we will watch on the fifth Sunday of the month. And so he'll give you a little bit more information about this one, and then we'll be on to it.
Well, let me unload on my papers. As Greta said, one of my things I like to do is, as I have breakfast in the morning, watch a TED Talk. And there are lots of excellent TED Talks, and I've created a list of about 15 that are kind of favorites of mine, and so from that, we chose one this morning. But how this came to be me was I somehow let Greta know that I did watch these TED Talks every morning, and I think she went away and said, aha, that's how I'm going to get Dennis up here. So here I am. I am a bit concerned when we show videos on the screens that the sound is more difficult to hear than when microphones are being used. And if you sit close to the side, get close to the loudspeakers, you'll do better. But the way the building is designed, there's lots of echoing taking place, and that makes it somewhat difficult. So in selecting the TED Talk, I've kind of looked at the content as being very important, but also the speaker to make sure that his diction is clear and not too fast. So this morning, we're going to watch a TED Talk by Steven Pinker, who is a well-known psychologist. Steven grew up in English-speaking Montreal and spent his adult life shuffling back and forth between Harvard and MIT. He is interested in all aspects of human nature, how we see, hear, think, speak, remember, and feel and interact. In his recent book, Enlightenment Now, and look at the thickness of it, there's a lot of enlightenment in there, I think. The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress, he writes about progress, why people are healthier, richer, safer, happier, and better educated than ever. The TED Talk you're about to watch is from his book and is titled, Is the World Getting Better or Worse? So, Peter, over to you.
Many people face the news each morning with trepidation and dread. Every day we read of shootings, inequality, pollution, dictatorship, war, and the spread of nuclear weapons. These are some of the reasons that 2016 was called the worst year ever, until 2017 claimed that record, and left many people longing for earlier decades when the world seemed safer, cleaner, and more equal. But is this a sensible way to understand the human condition in the 21st century? As Franklin Pierce Adams pointed out, nothing is more responsible for the good old days than a bad memory. You can always fool yourself into seeing a decline if you compare bleeding headlines of the present with rose-tinted images of the past. What does the trajectory of the world look like when we measure well-being over time using a constant yardstick? Let's compare the most recent data on the present with the same measures 30 years ago. Last year, Americans killed each other at a rate of 5.3 per 100,000, had 7% of their citizens in poverty, and emitted 21 million tons of particulate matter and 4 million tons of sulfur dioxide. But 30 years ago, the homicide rate was 8.5 per 100,000, poverty rate was 12%, and we emitted 35 million tons of particulate matter and 20 million tons of sulfur dioxide. What about the world as a whole? Last year, the world had 12 ongoing wars, 60 autocracies, 10% of the world population in extreme poverty, and more than 10,000 nuclear weapons. But 30 years ago, there were 23 wars, 85 autocracies, 37% of the world population in extreme poverty, and more than 60,000 nuclear weapons. True, last year was a terrible year for terrorism in Western Europe, with 238 deaths. But 1988 was worse, with 440 deaths. What's going on? Is 1988 a particularly bad year? Or are these improvements a sign that the world, for all its troubles, gets better over time? Might we even invoke the admittedly old-fashioned notion of progress? To do so is to court a certain amount of derision, because I have found that intellectuals hate progress. And intellectuals who call themselves progressive really hate progress. Now, it's not that they hate the fruits of progress, mind you. Most academics and pundits would rather have their surgery with anesthesia than without it. It's the idea of progress that rankles the chattering class. If you believe that humans can improve their lot, I have been told, that means that you have a blind faith and a quasi-religious belief in the outmoded superstition and the false promise of the myth of the onward march of inexorable progress. You are a cheerleader for vulgar American can-doism, with the rah-rah spirit of boardroom ideology, Silicon Valley, and the Chamber of Commerce. You are a practitioner of Whig history, a naive optimist, a Pollyanna, and of course a pangloss, alluding to the Voltaire character who declared, "All is for the best in the best of all possible worlds." Well, Professor Pangloss, as it happens, was a pessimist. A true optimist believes there could be much better worlds than the one we have today. But all of this is irrelevant because the question of whether progress has taken place is not a matter of faith or having an optimistic temperament or seeing the glasses half full. It's a testable hypothesis. For all their differences, people largely agree on what goes into human well-being. Life, health, sustenance, prosperity, peace, freedom, safety, knowledge, leisure, happiness. All of these things can be measured. If they have improved over time, that, I submit, is progress. Let's go to the data. Beginning with the most precious thing of all, life. For most of human history, life expectancy at birth was around 30. Today, worldwide, it is more than 70, and in the developed parts of the world, more than 80. 250 years ago, in the richest countries of the world, a third of the children did not live to see their fifth birthday. Before the risk was brought down 100-fold, today that fate befalls less than 6% of children in the poorest countries of the world. Famine is one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse and could bring devastation to any part of the world. Today, famine has been banished to the most remote and war-ravaged regions. 200 years ago, 90% of the world's population subsisted in extreme poverty. Today, fewer than 10% of people do. For most of human history, the powerful states and empires were pretty much always at war with each other, and peace was a mere interlude between wars. Today, they are never at war with each other. The last great power war pitted the United States against China 65 years ago. More recently, wars of all kinds have become fewer and less deadly. The annual rate of war has fallen from about 22 per 100,000 per year in the early 50s to 1.2 today. Democracy has suffered obvious setbacks in Venezuela, in Russia, in Turkey, and is threatened by the rise of authoritarian populism in Eastern Europe and the United States. Yet the world has never been more democratic than it has been in the past decade, with two-thirds of the world's people living in democracies. Homicide rates plunge whenever anarchy and the code of vendetta are replaced by the rule of law. It happened when feudal Europe was brought under the control of centralized kingdoms, so that today a Western European has 1/35th the chance of being murdered compared to his medieval ancestors. It happened again in colonial New England, in the American Wild West when the sheriffs moved to town, and in Mexico. Indeed, we've become safer in just about every way. Over the last century, we've become 96% less likely to be killed in a car crash, 88% less likely to be mowed down on the sidewalk, 99% less likely to die in a plane crash, 95% less likely to be killed on the job, 89% less likely to be killed by an act of God, such as a drought, flood, wildfire, storm, volcano, landslide, earthquake, or meteor strike, presumably not because God has become less angry with us, but because of improvements in the resilience of our infrastructure. And what about the quintessential act of God, the projectile hurled by Zeus himself? Yes, we are 97% less likely to be killed by a bolt of lightning. Before the 17th century, no more than 15% of Europeans could read or write. Europe and the United States achieved universal literacy by the middle of the 20th century, and the rest of the world is catching up. Today, more than 90% of the world's population under the age of 25 can read and write. In the 19th century, Westerners worked more than 60 hours per week. Today, they work fewer than 40. Thanks to the universal penetration of running water and electricity in the developed world, and the widespread adoption of washing machines, vacuum cleaners, refrigerators, dishwashers, stoves, and microwaves, the amount of our lives that we forfeit to housework has fallen from 60 hours a week to fewer than 15 hours a week. Do all these gains in health, wealth, safety, knowledge, and leisure make us any happier? The answer is yes. In 86% of the world's countries, happiness has increased in recent decades. Well, I hope to have convinced you that progress is not a matter of faith or optimism, but is a fact of human history. Indeed, the greatest fact in human history. And how has this fact been covered in the news? A tabulation of positive and negative emotion words in news stories has shown that during the decades in which humanity has gotten healthier, wealthier, wiser, safer, and happier, the New York Times has become increasingly morose, and the world's broadcasts, too, have gotten steadily glummer. Why don't people appreciate progress? Part of the answer comes from our cognitive psychology. We estimate risk using a mental shortcut called the availability heuristic. The easier it is to recall something from memory, the more probable we judge it to be. The other part of the answer comes from the nature of journalism, captured in a satirical headline from The Onion. CNN holds morning meeting to decide what viewers should panic about for the rest of the day. News is about stuff that happens, not stuff that doesn't happen. You never see a journalist who says, "I'm reporting live from a country that has been at peace for 40 years, or a city that has not been attacked by terrorists." Also, bad things can happen quickly, but good things aren't built in a day. The papers could have run the headline, 137,000 people escaped from extreme poverty yesterday, every day for the last 25 years. That's 1.25 billion people leaving poverty behind, but you never read about it. Also, the news capitalizes on our morbid interest in what can go wrong, captured in the programming policy, if it bleeds, it leads. Well, if you combine our cognitive biases with the nature of news, you can see why the world has been coming to an end for a very long time indeed. Let me address some questions about progress that no doubt have occurred to many of you. First, isn't it good to be pessimistic, to safeguard against complacency, to rake the muck, to speak truth to power? Well, not exactly. It's good to be accurate. Of course, we should be aware of suffering and danger wherever they occur, but we should also be aware of how they can be reduced, because there are dangers to indiscriminate pessimism. One of them is fatalism. If all our efforts at improving the world have been in vain, why throw good money after bad? The poor will always be with you. And since the world will end soon, if climate change doesn't kill us all, then runaway artificial intelligence will, a natural response is to enjoy life while we can. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. The other danger of thoughtless pessimism is radicalism. If our institutions are all failing and beyond hope for reform, a natural response is to seek to smash the machine, drain the swamp, burn the empire to the ground, on the hope that whatever rises out of the ashes is bound to be better than what we have now. Well, if there is such a thing as progress, what causes it? Progress is not some mystical force or dialectic lifting us ever higher. It's not a mysterious arc of history bending toward justice. It's the result of human efforts governed by an idea. An idea that we associate with the 18th century Enlightenment, namely that if we apply reason and science to enhance human well-being, we can gradually succeed. Is progress inevitable? Of course not. Progress does not mean that everything becomes better for everyone, everywhere, all the time. That would be a miracle. And progress is not a miracle, but problem solving. Problems are inevitable. And solutions create new problems which have to be solved in their turn. The unsolved problems facing the world today are gargantuan, including the risks of climate change and nuclear war. But we must see them as problems to be solved, not apocalypses in waiting. and aggressively pursue solutions like deep decarbonization for climate change and global zero for nuclear war. Finally, does the Enlightenment go against human nature? This is an acute question for me, because I'm a prominent advocate of the existence of human nature with all its shortcomings and perversities. In my book, The Blank Slate, I argue that the human prospect is more tragic than utopian, and that we are not stardust, we are not golden, and there's no way we're getting back to the garden. But my worldview has lightened up in the 15 years since The Blank Slate was published. My acquaintance with the statistics of human progress, starting with violence, but now encompassing every other aspect of our well-being, has fortified my belief that in understanding our tribulations and woes, human nature is the problem, but human nature, channeled by Enlightenment norms and institutions, is also the solution. Admittedly, it's not easy to replicate my own data-driven epiphany with humanity at large. Some intellectuals have responded with fury to my book Enlightenment Now, saying, first, how dare he claim that intellectuals hate progress? And second, how dare he claim that there has been progress? With others, the idea of progress just leaves them cold. Saving the lives of billions, eradicating disease, feeding the hungry, teaching kids to read? Boring. At the same time, the most common response I've received from readers is gratitude. Gratitude for changing their view of the world from a numb and helpless fatalism to something more constructive, even heroic. I believe that the ideals of the Enlightenment can be cast as a stirring narrative, and I hope that people with greater artistic flair and rhetorical power than I can tell it better and spread it further. It goes something like this. We are born into a pitiless universe, facing steep odds against life-enabling order and in constant jeopardy of falling apart. We were shaped by a process that is ruthlessly competitive. We are made from crooked timber, vulnerable to illusions, self-centeredness, and at times, astounding stupidity. Yet, human nature has also been blessed with resources that open a space for a kind of redemption. We are endowed with the power to combine ideas recursively, to have thoughts about our thoughts. We have an instinct for language, allowing us to share the fruits of our ingenuity and experience. We are deepened with a capacity for sympathy, for pity, imagination, compassion, commiseration. These endowments have found ways to magnify their own power. The scope of language has been augmented by the written, printed, and electronic word. Our circle of sympathy has been expanded by history, journalism, and the narrative arts. And our puny rational faculties have been multiplied by the norms and institutions of reason. Intellectual curiosity, open debate, skepticism of authority and dogma, and the burden of proof to verify ideas by confronting them against reality. As the spiral of recursive improvement gathers momentum, we eke out victories against the forces that grind us down, not least the darker parts of our own nature. We penetrate the mysteries of the cosmos, including life and mind. We live longer, suffer less, learn more, get smarter, and enjoy more small pleasures and rich experiences. Fewer of us are killed, assaulted, enslaved, exploited, or oppressed by the others. From a few oases, the territories with peace and prosperity are growing and could someday encompass the globe. Much suffering remains, and tremendous peril. But ideas on how to reduce them have been voiced, and an infinite number of others are yet to be conceived. We will never have a perfect world, and it would be dangerous to seek one. But there's no limit to the betterments we can attain if we continue to apply knowledge to enhance human flourishing. This heroic story is not just another myth. Myths are fictions, but this one is true. True to the best of our knowledge, which is the only truth we can have. As we learn more, we can show which parts of the story continue to be true and which ones false, as any of them might be and any could become. And this story belongs not to any tribe, but to all of humanity, to any sentient creature with the power of reason and the urge to persist in its being. for it requires only the convictions that life is better than death, health is better than sickness, abundance is better than want, freedom is better than coercion, happiness is better than suffering, and knowledge is better than ignorance and superstition. Thank you.
I also have, I think, five slides, and I apologize that the quality, you can't really read them on there, but I'll try and explain them to you as I go along, but they also to point out the progress that is taking place. So, Peter, could I have the first one? This is a slide of the world population growth from 1750 through to 2100. Now, part of it is a forecast, but I think the significant thing you can take from this graph is the percentage growth rate of the population peaked out back about 1970 and has been falling rather dramatically since then, which means world population growth is in fact slowing, and we're not going to have a steady incline like we had probably in the early 1900s. The next slide. This is a global surface area allocation for food production. And the top bar, and it's out of scale because the dark part at the top is the land. Of the total earth, which is 29% is land and 71% is ocean. So if we showed that to scale, the rest of the picture wouldn't make much sense. It'd be all too small. So you take the 29% land coverage that we have in the world, and 71%, which is the next bar below, is habitable land. 10% is glacier and 19% is barren. So a good part of the world's surface is habitable. Taking the habitable land, going down to the next bar, 50% is used by agriculture, 37% by forests, 11% by shrubs, 1% by urban or cities, and 1% fresh water. So a good part of the world habitable land is used for agriculture. The next bar down is rather interesting. Of the 50% that is agriculture, 77% is consumed by livestock and 23% by crops. So it's a real imbalance. Yet, only 17% of the livestock provides only 17% of the protein value that we need, and crops provide 83%. So, you know, I think we have some problems, and knowledge hopefully will find a way to solve these going into the future. On the next slide, this is certainly totally unreadable, but the graph is going down rather steeply. And what it is the amount of land needed to produce the same amount of food value. So we're getting much smarter in how we use the land that we do have for generating food for people. The next slide is a change of subject. It's the rate of illiterate versus illiterate people in the world. And again, we've got out of sync here. Okay, thanks, Peter. I should be able to see, but it's not so easy to see around the corner here. As you can see, a very dramatic drop. The scale goes from 1800 to 2014. The number of illiterate people have dropped down to 13% from a high of 87%. So, you know, great progress is being made. And in the next slide, We have the share of the world population living in absolute poverty. And again, you can see a very dramatic decline. And just by chance, as I was sitting and getting my eye examination earlier this week, there happened to be a National Geographic magazine, and thumbing through it, it was February 2018, and there was a really excellent article on the progress in China. And one of the things that really stands out is their ability. What they've done is they've decreased the poor people in that country to almost zero. They have two other classes that are the working income and up and middle income. And I think going back to the original side of the improvement here in the poverty level, that China has had a major impact on the world. Unfortunately, the area of the world where poverty still retains a high level is in Africa, sub-Saharan area. And until they can solve the problems of their wars and so on, be a while before they'll catch up. Okay, and the last screen is the world population living in extreme poverty, and you can see the number of persons in green that are not in poverty anymore is dramatically increased. So all of these tend to support Steven Pinker and his analysis of how well we are. Now, just to, before I finish, out in the front by where you pick up your badge, I've put out a bit of a very simple questionnaire, which asks you to, if you'll take a moment on your, before you leave, to let us know how easy it is for you to hear the microphone. That's kind of a reference. And then how easy it is to hear the video when they're broadcast. I'd like to get a comparison of those two. Now, anybody have any comments, thoughts on what we've seen today? Must have been too perfect. Well, I have about 15 or 16 more, but at the rate of four a year, we may never get through them all. Anyway, thank you.
This is my book that I brought in for Dennis to wave around, and I haven't written in the margins of a book like this, you know, to this extent for quite some time, so it's a very interesting read. Thank you, Dennis, and hopefully it will bubble over in some conversation there. And it is a reality that I often bring to you challenging situations in the world, and I rarely bring to you, you know, the ways that things are getting so much better. So we'll try to shift that a bit without allowing you to remain ignorant of some of the things that need to happen in the world. But Pinker really does say, you know, if you look at the numbers, the world is getting better, and that makes no difference. I remember Alan Conker, whose son drowned at the age of three, saying, statistics mean nothing if you're on the wrong side of them. And that is very true. And so as we go from this place, uplifted by some of the knowledge that we have gained through this, may we also go with hearts tender toward those whose lives continue to hold struggle and hurt. And may we find ways to embrace them with hope. So go from this place in peace.
May your world be a world of love. May we
have been listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to www.westhill.net/donate.